Hello and welcome to the Revolutionary Action Dance Party, produced out of CHSR 97.9 FM in Fredericton. I'm Pierre Loiselle. Over the past few years, Pacifica Radio's authorities have coercively transformed a people's network into a nearly corporate structure. Their latest attack has been upon Democracy Now!, one of the few effective sources of honest analysis and reporting in the U.S. On this edition of the Revolutionary Action Dance Party, we cover a portion of this struggle for the airwaves. In addition, we present a talk given by Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, recorded at an independent media convergence in Vermont on October 13th, 2000. Please stay tuned. Pacifica is the U.S.'s leading progressive radio network, holding licenses to five stations, with affiliate stations in dozens of other communities. Pacifica's Berkeley station, KPFA, was the first listener-sponsored radio station in the world, founded in 1949 by Lou Hill. He created KPFA in Berkeley with a vision of building listener-sponsored community radio with a diverse range of voices. His idea soon inspired a five-station network of autonomously run operations in New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Berkeley, and later Houston, Texas. Ever since, Pacifica has been one of the few U.S. media outlets to regularly cover news and public affairs from a progressive point of view. The Pacifica network has been in crisis since early 1999, when questions about Pacifica's direction intensified and reports of the possible sale of KPFA and other stations emerged. These new directions were regarded by both its reporters and many listeners as neutralizing Pacifica's progressive, that is, left-wing, reporting. This assault to privatize and strangle the people's airwaves then suppressed dissension on the air. Pacifica management hired armed guards to intimidate KPFA's workers and try to prevent them from discussing the issues openly on the air where listeners could be informed. They then shut down the station, locking out KPFA's entire 200-person staff. Demonstrations brought some 15,000 people to the streets in the Bay Area and nationally. Due to massive support, KPFA was back on the air within 3 weeks. But at some local stations, and at its Washington, D.C. National News Bureau, Pacifica is continuing acts of censorship, not only of news reports and analysis, but of on-air critiques of the news and public affairs programming. On a couple of occasions, Democracy Now!, the network's most popular show, was censored. The day after management locked out staff, Pacifica managers pulled Democracy Now! From KPFK, WPFW, and KPFA. The main story on this episode addressed the KPFA crisis. This was not the only program that was censored, but the beginning of a coup. A news producer for Pacifica's KPFK in Los Angeles was banned from the station in 1999 when she wrote an article for an alternative newspaper critical of Pacifica policies. Pacifica has also used its gag rule as an excuse to fire KPFA programmers who mentioned the crisis within the Pacifica network on the air, even when corporate media was reporting on the crisis. And Pacifica network news director Dan Guglin was removed from his job when he ran a 2-minute news story on a national boycott of Pacifica programming. Author and political analyst Michael Parenti at an independent media convergence in Vermont described another trend that is being used to suppress spoken word programming.
Pacifica has a potential audience of about 40 million. It has five stations. Three of them have already been totally neutralized. The one in Houston, the one in Washington, D.C., and almost completely KPFK in L.A., and now more and more at WBAI. The neutralization process is getting rid of public affairs and putting music on. The WPFW in Washington literally is almost all music.
Pacifica Network News, PNN, is a daily half-hour news program that airs on some 70 radio stations in the U.S. On January 31st, 40 freelance reporters, the voice for PNN from across the Americas, Europe, and Asia, fell silent in solidarity. They are on strike. They state that they've, quote, been compelled as a last resort to withhold labor in order to try to prevent the destruction of Pacifica as a respected and independent news source. They are striking to end censorship of news and public affairs programs throughout the Pacifica network. They could no longer contribute their work to an institution whose management is destroying Pacifica's proud 50-year-long tradition of free speech, open debate, and community-controlled radio. They are calling on management to publicly renounce censorship throughout the network and to reassert the editorial independence of each station's news division as well as its programming. Their demands include the reinstatement of Pacifica Network news director Dan Kuglin, who was censored and reassigned. In the latest episode of Pacifica Crackdowns, the host of Democracy Now! Reports that management is trying to gut the program's political content. Host Amy Goodman received a memo from the network's program director, Steve Yaskow, which demanded, amongst other things, that she cease to use volunteers on the show and refrain from speaking engagements without consent of management. On October 18th, in a letter addressed to Pacifica's board of directors, Amy Goodman's response included the following. In the three-page memo, Yaskow listed a series of Pacifica policies and work rules that I was ordered to immediately adhere to or face disciplinary actions up to and including termination. In my opinion, there is something far bigger than a mere work rules dispute involved here. It is the desire of management to rein in and exert political control over Democracy Now! It intensified this summer when Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Wash had our press credentials pulled after we brought Ralph Nader into the Republican convention to be interviewed and do color commentary. Management's actions made it much more difficult to cover the Democrats in the same hard-hitting, confrontational way we had reported on the Republicans, especially when it came to our focus on corporate control of the conventions. The motivation is blatantly political. Democracy Now! Is a hard-hitting grassroots program that is not afraid of tackling controversial issues day after day in the Pacifica tradition. We are not only being censored for our critical coverage of the Democrats as well as the Republicans, but for giving a voice to a growing grassroots movement that fundamentally challenges the status quo, people fighting sweatshops, police brutality, prison growth, and corporate globalization. On September 14th, Steve Yaskow called me to a meeting with Pacifica general managers. KPFK manager Mark Shubb expressed his repeated criticism that audiences don't want to hear graphic details of police brutality before breakfast. Or, as he said last year, before I have my coffee. He criticized our coverage of Mumia Abu-Jamal, East Timor, and questioned why I asked Spike Lee about his affiliation with Nike. I'm being subjected to a concerted campaign of abuse and harassment by Pacifica management. It has also happened during a time when Democracy Now! Is growing in audience, in media coverage, and in fundraising from both listeners and foundations. That is, we are growing in all the areas the Pacifica board says it is concerned with. But instead of congratulations and kudos for our many accomplishments, Pacifica has clamped down and threatens me at every turn with dismissal. As I write this, Yaskow is forging ahead with imposing two new producers on Democracy Now!, with or without the consent of co-hosts Juan Gonzalez and me. The two producers, our only producers, are the heart of this show. It is clear from all of management's actions they are using this opportunity to change the political direction of the program. This is the first time that we have been clearly told that our consent is not necessary. Take this section from the Yaskow memo. Quote, "To establish an appropriate balance between your programming obligations and any speaking engagements and related travel, you are not to accept any speaking engagements without first informing the foundation and obtaining approval. It is also important to know whom you are speaking to." This is an outrageous intrusion into my personal life and an illegal attempt to control my right of free speech. Given the many large and enthusiastic audiences I am often invited to address, I would think Pacifica would be glad for the positive publicity. Instead, Yaskow demands veto power over when I speak and whom I speak to, and he tries to camouflage the crackdown with concern for my welfare or statements such as, quote, "You are, of course, a valued voice in spreading the word of our mission, programs, and goals." I am so valued that he is ready to fire me if I don't follow unethical and illegal orders. Amy Goodman's letter ended with, "We are not NPR. We are not U.S. government media. We are not the corporate media. We are Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Sincerely, Amy Goodman, host Democracy Now!" The independent media community began mobilizing when this memo was leaked. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, issued an action alert to mobilize support for Democracy Now! Media Alliance of San Francisco and FAIR called for nationwide demonstrations, which were held on October 24th. Hundreds of Pacifica listeners and staff participated. In retaliation, KPFT management singled out and fired the producer of a new show called Thresholds because he participated in these protests to support Democracy Now! This is not the first time that Pacifica managers have fired employees when they exercised their free speech rights. At the demonstration outside KPFA in Berkeley, Norman Solomon, media critic, said,
"More than anything else, this is about a political house cleaning, a purge being implemented or attempted by top Pacifica management led by the so-called leaders on the board of directors.
Like in 1995!
It's a purge going on that is trying to implement an ideological litmus test that says, if you are more progressive than Al Gore, get off of our airwaves or shut up about it. That's what it's boiling down to. It is the mentality of what we might call corporatism, repression, projection of their own value systems."
This ideology that Solomon refers to has taken reign over the approach of journalism, whereby alternative media parrots the voice of corporate media. Michael Parenti.
And again, it's this very idea that mainly that you have an idea that independent media, the people who work in these things, actually come out and say, we want to do professional, objective journalism. They have actually, in the independent media, bought into the mainstream mythologies of what mainstream, what journalism really is. And so the news sounds, again, like NPR. The guy literally read off the cable NBC wires and the Associated Press wires, and that's what you get. President Clinton today, and that's what it is, it's really rather dismaying.
Independent radio is a powerful tool for challenging the corporate agenda, and this is clearly understood by the powers that be. That is why it is being attacked with such vigor. The airwaves belong to the people, not multinational companies and ad agencies that mold our consciousness by suppressing some information while repeatedly pounding in other messages. It is time to reclaim our airwaves. For more information, including detailed lists of Pacifica's acts of censorship and the PNN strikers' demands, check out http://www.savepacifica.net.
The right to assemble, petition, and speak is strongly supported by Time and Newsweek. But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low. There are those who will not let the churches tell them what to think, but when the television does the same, they don't even blink. So it's goo goo gaga, drugs are everywhere. Mommy, mommy, protect me from the commie. 100,000 demonstrators cannot be denied, but if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Amy Goodman is news director and host of Democracy Now! At Pacifica Station, WBAI in New York. She has covered U.S. foreign policy and reported for Pacifica in Mexico, Haiti, and Indonesia. She won awards for breaking the story on a massacre of peaceful demonstrators in East Timor and received a 1999 George Polk Award for her work on Drilling and Killing, Chevron in Nigeria. She spoke in Burlington, Vermont on October 13th at an independent media convergence. Her presentation was entitled Media Crimes and Deceptions. We will now go to Amy Goodman.
It is astounding what the media, the public media, has become in this country, both radio and television, and something we really have to fight against. We have to reclaim our airwaves from the corporations and from those who are saying they're protecting the airwaves in our name. A couple months ago, I was asked to give a Shmio Award. That's the sort of the ceremony that goes on at the same time that the Clio Awards are given out for the best in advertising, and this is for the worst in advertising. And I was asked to give a Shmio to PBS, to public broadcasting overall. So I was doing a little research to see just how extensive these commercials were and learned a lot of disturbing things. Like, you know, Sesame Street used to be brought to you by the number two and the letter A. which is a really nice idea and a sort of play on commercialism, but not commercialism. Well, today it's brought to you, and this is not my joke, this is theirs, or we wish it was, brought to you by the number 2 and the letter Z for Zithromax by Pfizer. Believe it or not, still on Sesame Street. And the commercialization of the media and the serving up of children to these companies is very disturbing. We expect it in the commercial media, but somehow we expect kids to be protected from it on the public airwaves. They even become the babysitters for kids, and you can walk away because you think they'll be well taken care of. But I think we have to be a lot more careful now. I don't know if you have very young kids, but you know Teletubbies are all the rage for the, what, the 1, 2, and 3-year-old set. That's Tinky Winky, Dipsy, Lala, and Poe. Well, they're brought to PBS by their North American marketers, the Itsy Bitsy Entertainment Company, which has formed an alliance at different times with Burger King and with McDonald's. Now, these corporations need the good name of PBS because the parents are unwittingly themselves serving up their children. In the press release this past year, when Itsy Bitsy Entertainment, who brings you PBS's program, Teletubbies, put out its press release saying that it was going to be working with McDonald's, it said, "We're delighted that McDonald's has chosen to support the quality program that is available to children every day on PBS." And the press release goes on to say, "McDonald's has been serving and caring for young people for years, and we are proud to team up with a company that is as children and family oriented as they are." And so they serve up the children of this country to this hungry corporation without their parents even quite being aware. And then the kids want to go to McDonald's where they can get the Teletubbies Hugs Happy Meal, and they can get all the little charms of the Teletubbies with their meal. And this is being done really with the consent of PBS. And PBS is teaching corporations how to target their, what they're calling, unfortunately, markets now. For example, this past spring, on March 13th, 14th, 2000, the Institute for International Research sponsored a marketing conference in New York City called Playtime, Snack Time, Tot Time, targeting preschoolers and their parents. Among the presenters scheduled, among the tot experts, well, the tot experts scheduled to teach toddler marketing executives at the conference were among them Michelle Miller, editor of PBS Kids Online, teaching the corporate marketers, among other things, quote, conducting research with preschoolers and, quote, using the strengths of the web to communicate with pre-readers. This is what, unfortunately, more and more PBS is becoming. And then you have the project of Children's Television Workshop teaming up with Nickelodeon, the for-profit company, to form Noggin. Noggin goes into a suburban school in the Northeast, gives them thousands of dollars, these very hard-up public schools, and says, "Can we come into your school and do marketing research?" And so they go in once a month, or it might be once a week, I'm not sure, with the young ones, and they have them do an All About Me journal, which is a really nice thing and gives the teachers a little time off. And the kids write all about themselves. For themselves? No. Those little journals are collected and Noggin keeps them, which represents both Children's Television Workshop, which is why you could be sure this public school is letting them in, and the for-profit arm, Nickelodeon. It's top research. And then, of course, the very damaging, just the soft drink exclusive contracts that are now going into the schools, so that next to the gyms, you have these contracts, multi-million contracts, million-dollar contracts that schools have with Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, and that's what the kids end up drinking. It's harder to find a working water fountain than to find a Coke if you could just find a few cents to put it in, has replaced water, not only in developing countries, but right here at home for kids. These are very serious issues. And it's not just kids that are being targeted, that are being really abused. It's adults too. Now again, we expect to be aware, and we're very vigilant when it comes to commercial television, but we have to be very careful when it comes to public television. This is a press release that I got from FAIR about some of the documentaries that have been rejected by PBS and accepted by PBS. Here's one that was rejected. Defending Our Lives, an Academy Award-winning documentary about domestic violence. Why was it rejected? One of the producers was the leader of a battered women's support group, and PBS felt that gave her a, quote, direct vested interest in the subject matter of the program. I guess she was against domestic violence. So let's look at what was accepted, what was distributed by PBS. The prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. That was a 1993 series funded by Payne Weber, a company with significant oil interests. The series' main analyst was Daniel Yergin, a consultant to major oil companies. Almost every expert featured was a defender of the oil industry. That was accepted, but a program called Defending Our Lives on Domestic Violence was rejected. It had a point of view. Another program rejected, Out at Work, a 97 film about workplace discrimination against gays and lesbians. Why? Well, it was partially funded by unions and a lesbian group. PBS acknowledged the underwriters had clearly not controlled the program's content and that it was compelling television, responsibly done, but still refused to distribute it. Supported by unions. So what did it accept? Living Against the Odds, a special on risk assessment that asserted, quote, we have to stop pointing the finger at industry for every environmental hazard. Funded by Chevron, a petrochemical company often criticized for environmental pollution, not to mention killing Nigerian villagers, but we'll get to that. Okay, what else did PBS reject? It's a documentary that would not air public broadcasting, The Moneylenders, a film about the World Bank. Why? PBS was concerned that, quote, even though the documentary may seem objective to some, there is a perception of bias in favor of poor people who claim to be adversely affected. What was accepted? James Reston, The Man Millions Read, a flattering documentary about the New York Times' most famous pundit. The film was funded by and produced in association with the New York Times. The director and producer, Susan Dreyfus, a part of the Sulzberger family that owns the paper and is the daughter of a former Times publisher. So there you have the list, the rejects, and the ones that get to be seen. Not on NBC or ABC or CBS or Time Warner. This on public broadcasting. Is there any hope? Yes, and it's independent media in this country. And we saw it rise up, not first, but most spectacularly in Seattle, when tens of thousands of people took to the streets. In a remarkable moment, a turning point at the end of the century, a real Gettysburg, when people from all over the world gathered, who came together and simply said no. This was a global uprising against corporate power. And who was going to cover it? Well, hundreds of people from around the world as well said, this uprising against corporate power is not gonna just be seen through a corporate lens. And so they came together, we came together, with pens and pencils, tape recorders, and video cameras to bring you not a corporate filtered look at what was happening, but as close to the story as possible. And as one person carrying a video camera would get tear gassed and arrested, they would hand that video camera on to the next person. And so you saw this really amazing movement which was focused in Seattle at the IMC, the Independent Media Center. These centers now cropping up all over the world. People educating each other, learning to use the internet, some extremely advanced in this, some never having touched it before. The Luddites in the world who had gathered there with their pencils. Maybe that was even too technologically advanced, I don't know. But everyone coming together and saying, we're going to cover this in a different way. And that is the movement that threatens public broadcasting right now, or is a really serious counter to it. Could be, if we take it very seriously, if we support it. Not only in Seattle, it was in Philadelphia at the Republican Convention, hundreds of people there in an IMC right in the middle of it. In Los Angeles at the Democratic Convention at Patriotic Hall, there were the people on the sixth floor who were doing their work, directly hearing from the streets, being out on the streets, in the prisons, finding out what was happening and getting it out online through pictures, through script and simple print, on the telephone, using advanced technological means and very basic means to get their stories out around the world. Now, this is a true revolution in its beginning. You know, the internet, I think, is extremely important because you have this corporate globalization that is taking place, and what these corporations fear more than anything, and these are powerful entities, of the 100 most powerful economies, the 100 wealthiest economies in the world, more than half of them not countries, corporations. But what they fear more than anything is the same model, that globalization model, happening from the grassroots, and that is what is happening right now. And it can be facilitated by the internet. We've got to use it or we're going to lose it. It is being privatized quickly, like everything else, like the prisons in this country, like information, and we have to challenge that. We've got to use it for very principled means, and that's, but one that knows these movements. That is the most educated and perceptive and most important and responsible independent media. I wanted to talk a little about just personally working on the ground and some of the stories that it is so critical that we cover, especially in this year 2000 of the presidential campaign. Here you have George Bush and Al Gore in the last debate. Perhaps the only honest thing that happened in that second, what I call debate light, that's named after Budweiser Light, because it is Anheuser-Busch that sponsors the debates of the commission on presidential debates. Incredible. You know that in Boston, the first debate, there were the reporters wearing their Ford Motor Company press passes, said Ford Motor Company on them. No, I didn't hear any questions about the responsibility of corporations like Firestone and Ford for the deaths of how many people, and not just should they be sued, should the government take them on, or maybe even revoke their charter. That would be interesting, a question. But what about criminal liability? No, you don't have questions like that when the press is sporting their Ford Motor Company press credentials and playing ping pong on tables that say Budweiser Light, and drinking their Budweiser beers, because this is democracy, folks. This is what their democracy looks like, which is why we have to cover those that chant, this is what democracy looks like in the streets, and not just talk about their lack of focus as the protesters bring up all these different issues. I didn't hear a very focused debate the other night on the part of the presidential candidates. And when was the last time you might have talked to Democratic or Republican delegates at these conventions? Seems they've got a lot of concerns as well. It doesn't take away from them. It means that they are broad. They care about many issues. They are multi-issued. But for protesters who bring up all these issues, they're unfocused, they're fuzzy, they don't know what side they're on, what cause they think is more important than the next. No, people see all of these issues as connected issues. The prison industrial complex that's growing in this country is very much connected to, when you look at who's in the prisons, the largest per capita prison population in the world at more than 2 million people, overwhelmingly poor, Black and Latino, yes, connected to the issues of the World Bank and other countries marginalizing people, and yes, people being uprooted in India because of the Narmada Dam that is sponsored, supported by the World Bank, but then they fight back and they fight the World Bank back. You have some victories, you have a lot of defeats. Yes, these issues are all connected, and people are not crazy when they make those connections. They're smart, they're intelligent, they're insightful. They see how corporations and states work together. And yes, they link the politics with the economics, and this is the response to that. This is what democracy looks like from the bottom up. It's critical that we support the independent media, but also continue to challenge the corporate media. Jeremy and I had a chance, and maybe some of you have already heard the story of our experience last year, after we did the documentary on Nigeria dealing with the mainstream media. It brought together a lot of issues. The documentary, which we did, was called Drilling and Killing Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. And it was the story of Chevron Corporation, which is the largest corporation headquartered in California, which is one of the largest oil companies doing its work in Nigeria, the most populous African country. We went to the Niger Delta and went to Elijah Land, which is an area like Ogoni Land, also, well, a ways away from Elijah Land. Ogoni Land is what Ken Sarawiwa made world famous as he traveled around the world to let people know about what Shell was doing to his people, 500,000 Ogoni people, with the pipelines crisscrossing overland in a way that they're never allowed in this country, with flares the sizes of apartment buildings that light up the sky at night as well as in the day. So these kids who grow up in Ogoni Land live in a land that is lit 24 hours a day. They don't have oil or gas for themselves, but they live under the light of this flame, and they never know a dark night. And they breathe in the pollution from these apartment building size flares that are almost outlawed completely in this country, but it's how these corporations burn off the gas in Nigeria cheaply. And that is what Ken Sarawiwa fought, the alliance between the Shell Corporation and the state, the supporting of the dictators there. You know, these oil companies, they continually say that they are working with the government. Yes, they work to shore up these governments so that they know that they will control the people, the governments of people like Sunny Abacha, for example. This is a corporation's best friend, a dictatorship like this, for years supported by the U.S. government. And then you have Chevron doing exactly the same thing. They did it in Elijah Land. The people rose up. They were sick of just one more oil spill that was killing their fish and their land and their livestock, which was their only livelihood. And they went off to the offshore drilling barge where Chevron was operating. And they said they would not leave this barge, about 100 people from local communities, until they could negotiate with the top men in Chevron. And they wanted it to be the American, because they knew the Americans were ultimately in control. They wanted to negotiate with George Kirkland, who was the head of Chevron Nigeria Limited, which is a fully and wholly owned subsidiary of Chevron in California. And they don't even hide that fact, as Shell tried to do, say it was separate in Nigeria than it was in the rest of the world and in the United States. George Kirkland wrote an interesting piece in Nigeria Oil and Gas, a magazine, that said, we, talking about the different companies in Nigeria, oil companies, we are not so much competing with each other as we are competing with the earth. And he went on to say, and that's a healthy way to look at it. This is the man they wanted to negotiate with. Well, they didn't get their way. They flew in one of the Nigerian spokespeople to negotiate with them. Ultimately, because they were less powerful than Chevron, they accepted this person. They sent him to their elders. They stayed on shore on the boat, and they waited to get word to find out if there would be compensation for the oil spill, if there would be jobs for the local youth, if there would be something that would come back to these communities as these corporations drill the wealth out of this country, provide the power to the most powerful countries in the world, and yet leave the people, the host communities, what they call themselves, even more powerless. And so the young people on board this boat waited to get word. Did the elders have a satisfactory negotiation? And then they were told they would wait one more day and get word from Chevron, and then they prepared to get off that barge. It all started on a Tuesday, and by Friday they were getting ready to leave, and helicopters, three Chevron helicopters, flew in on this Friday morning, May of 1998, and they thought it was Chevron executives coming to finalize the deal. And instead, the helicopters came down onto the barge, and out came the Nigerian military and the mobile police, known as the kill and go. That's the kill and go. And they opened fire on the protesters, escorted by Chevron helicopters and Chevron security. They killed two of the protesters, and they critically wounded a third. And then the Chevron personnel and the security rounded people up. They put 11 people in a containment vessel on the boat where they keep cargo, and they kept them there for hours, then transported them to Nigerian jails where some were tortured. And that is how protesters are treated in Nigeria by a U.S. corporation so that you can fill your tank. And that is a story that connects all of these different issues. And you're not crazy to talk about corporations and corporate power and environmental concerns and racism. All those things, it doesn't mean you're diffuse and scattered. It means that you're intelligent and that you've opened your eyes. And so, after hearing the story from the villagers, and we said, well, how did you know that they were Chevron helicopters, knowing that Chevron would say, you know, we can't control the Nigerian military, so, because these helicopters fly over us all the time. We know who the personnel are. We know them. And so we then headed back to Lagos, to the Chevron compound, which appropriately is surrounded by a moat, and it is like an American suburb, completely surrounded with security everywhere. It needs that security, you can be sure. And we got in and talked to a top spokesperson and asked, you know, who flew in the Nigerian military that day? And he said, we did. We flew them out in. And who were they? Well, they were the Navy and the mobile police. Who authorized them coming in? We did. Chevron did, he said. And we said, well, can we talk to anyone? Can you prove? Well, we really said, when he said we came out and the Nigerian military had to maintain control, we said, well, how do you even know what happened? He said, I'll bring out the person who was making sure that the soldiers came out in order onto the boat. And he brought out the head of NIS security, James Necco. He said, I was on that helicopter. These were the Chevron personnel. And they can arrogantly say this because they know that people in this country, they know that the press in this country, what are they going to care about what happens in Nigeria? And so we came back and we told the story in the United States, and Chevron said they wouldn't talk to us here in the United States because we'd already talked to their spokesperson for 3 hours, which was true. We had Chevron's side of the story, and no, it wasn't a pretty picture. And we did the documentary, and it won a few awards. And among the awards were the Overseas Press Club Award. And these kind of events are gatherings of journalists congratulating each other, and people talk about the highest values and standards in journalism. And it's a very illuminating time, almost as illuminating as those flares in Nigeria. It happened at night on May 22nd, 1999, the event in New York, a black tie affair, the awards for the finest in foreign overseas reporting. Jeremy and I weren't going to go, actually, because each of the dinners cost $125, even for the award winners. But we thought, well, maybe it was worth it because we heard Tom Brokaw was the MC, and we could record him saying just the name of our documentary, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. And maybe we could insert it into our documentary after the fact. And so we went and we stood at the back, and the evening began. All the famous faces were there. Leslie Stoll was there, and Frank Sesno, Tom Brokaw was there, and it was interesting. Richard Holbrooke was there. He was about to become the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and he was the keynote speaker of the night. Once again, you have the journalists cozying up to those in power. I also might add that this was in the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia. So it was quite something to have Richard Holbrooke being the keynote address to this group of reporters who cover wars, who cover bombings. I don't think you can even call these situations wars. This was an amazing opportunity to get up close and personal with one of those who was deeply involved with the bombing of Yugoslavia. You could call him the trigger man. So we were at the back and we saw the scene. The lights were lowered, and right before dinner began, they started by an overseas press club executive officer getting up, old newspaper man, and he said, before you have your dinner and we do the awards, I just wanted to say, in case you're overwhelmed by the difficulties that we face as foreign reporters, because those obstacles are great, there are rays of hope. Now, this was May of 1999. This was before August 30th, 1999, when East Timor had a remarkable vote for self-determination and independence. And why I bring that up is he said there are rays of hope. This was during the Indonesian occupation. Indonesia is treating reporters better now. And we're very proud of that fact. Now, this was a week where another massacre had taken place in Timor on the part of the Indonesian military and their militias. They had beaten up reporters once again, those that were telling the stories of what was happening, those that were not too afraid to be there and in the homes of the Timorese who were terrorized. And they were saying they congratulated Indonesia on their treatment of journalists. This was going to be an interesting night. So the lights went on and the filet mignon was served, and because we weren't eating, we went over to the man who just said that, and I asked him what made him think that Indonesia was treating the reporters any better. And he said, well, he was concerned about the beatings and the bannings and the killings of reporters in Indonesia, and so he had written a letter to the Foreign Ministry of Indonesia, and they'd written back and assured him that they were treating reporters better. I said, well, I had different information. And he said I could forward it to him and he would take a look. And I asked, you know, considering what had happened, it was even in the New York Times that week, what had happened with some reporters being threatened and beat up, would he consider going back on the stage and taking back what he had said? And he said no, and he sat down. So we sat at the back, and hungry journalists that we were looking, no, I won't say for someone to devour, but we were waiting for the event to begin. And we saw Richard Holbrooke going to the bathroom, so we went over. We thought this is a great opportunity to ask a question. And we asked a couple questions, one about, you know, if they were bombing Yugoslavia to save the people there. They had just bombed a petrochemical plant in the Danube, and couldn't this threaten all of the Balkans' environmental devastation? You know, sort of the idea of, you know, destroying the village in order to save it. And he said he had to go. And then we asked him about the Rambouillet Accord. This was what he had delivered to Milosevic, and Appendix B of the Rambouillet Accord said that you will accept a total occupation of all of Yugoslavia. You know, it was just ultimately Kosovo, but in that it said all of Yugoslavia, something that no country would accept. And he said something like, oh, he wasn't at Rambouillet. He wasn't at Rambouillet, but he delivered this accord that ultimately led to the bombing of Yugoslavia because Milosevic rejected it. Okay, and so that was that. And he's entitled not to answer our questions, to brush us off. But what we were more disturbed by was that the head of the Overseas Press Club came over to us and said, what do you think you're doing? We said, not eating. No, we said, we're asking questions. And she said, no, we've made an agreement. Richard Holbrooke said he wouldn't come if reporters asked him questions. I said, and you agreed to that? And I said, so he shouldn't have come then. You don't accept those kind of terms. This is a room filled with hundreds of reporters, and we're in the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia. Said he would not come if we said that we would ask him questions. So he went to the bathroom, she sat down, and we sat at the back, and then after people ate dinner, Richard Holbrooke gave his address. He was introduced by an NBC producer who got up and said, you know, it is my great honor to introduce Dick. She said, Dick's here, he's there, he's everywhere. I had lunch with him last week, and a friend of mine had breakfast with him. I mean, I don't know any reporter that he doesn't talk to. I mean, this man may be, she wasn't looking way in the back there, but this man may be a tiger on the world stage, but he is a pussycat at home with his wife, Cottie, who was formerly married to Peter Jennings. But anyway, Cottie Martin. And she then went on to say, this man will soon be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, our ambassador. And she said something like, we hope he will become our ambassador. And then she introduced our Dick Holbrooke. Richard Holbrooke got up. Again, it was in the midst of the bombing Yugoslavia, and he congratulated each of the news organizations by name, CBS, NBC, ABC, for their coverage of the bombing and suggested that they would, he said, when they come back to Washington, they'll know how grateful we feel. Because they were doing, of course, the bidding of the U.S. government. They were doing what needed to be done. The government needs this kind of press. I mean, Chomsky talks about it all the time. Manufacturing consent. That's what you need. You had the little bad moments like Albright, Berger, and Cohen, the ABCs of the War Department going off to Ohio State in an event that was live. And they couldn't quite control who was in their studio. It was by the way, it was a sort of private CNN production. And in fact, they said that press wasn't allowed to take more than a few minutes. But we, in the end, we wanted a lot more than that, because here you had this remarkable event where scores of people filled this gymnasium and started to protest. As Bernie Shaw said, I don't see six people who are complaining, something like that. And here you had this roar coming up from a cross-section of people in what they thought was the conservative heartland of this country. Yes, it was the heart of this country speaking out, from Vietnam veterans to students to substitute teachers like John Strange, who stood up and did ask a question and asked Madeleine Albright, as she talked about the bombing of Yugoslavia and getting rid of a dictator, as she talked about the bombing of Yugoslavia because human rights abuses were being committed, well, then why aren't we bombing Jakarta? Why aren't we bombing Jerusalem? Why aren't we? He was asking his questions, not being one who was for the bombing, but to show the hypocrisy. And when she tried to move on, as she does with all the big time journalists, he said, Madam Secretary, you didn't answer my question. Quite remarkable, and had a lot to teach the corporate journalists. And it's those events that aren't controlled where the administration got a sense of what I think is the majority opinion in this country, and polls indicate that. But what they rely on is the press, the so-called independent press, to manufacture consent. I think that's what Richard Holbrooke was applauding in that room that night, and why he felt so comfortable and knew if he laid down the law and said, I won't come if you ask me questions, that he'd get agreement. And so he got up and he really gave a major foreign policy address. And he made an announcement. He made news that night. He said he just learned from the head of CNN International, who's become the head of all CNN since then, Easton Jordan, that as we were having dinner, or they were having dinner, that Allied forces, that NATO forces had just bombed RTS, Radio Television Serbia. You know those pictures. We went back that night at the office and we saw the body parts being dragged out of the building. Now, if this wasn't a war crime, were these soldiers in this building? And as he said that, there was no response, some titters. There was a little laughter when he said, I learned it from CNN, and you know I believe everything I see on CNN. That was it. You know, the criticism of Milosevic and his press, that they're, you know, just there as his propaganda arm. You wouldn't have thought anything different in this room of hundreds of reporters as they smiled when he talked about the bombing of Radio Television Serbia. Who was in those buildings? Who were the hairdressers and the technicians who were inside that building that night? So that's what he announced to this group of journalists who were being honored for being the finest in reporting in this country. And then he went on to talk about ground troops, etc. And that was the end of the talk. And at the end, Jeremy had had enough, and we were at the back of the room. And so he walked forward and he said, as Holbrooke was finishing, Mr. Holbrooke, a question from the press, a question from the press. And he asked the question about the Rambouillet Accord and said, wasn't the bar set purposely too high to call for an Appendix B, Milosevic to accept an occupation of all of Yugoslavia deliberately so that NATO could come in and bomb? And as he shouted out that question to Holbrooke, who had finished his speech, Brokaw jumped up and told Jeremy to be quiet and sit down. And Jeremy repeated the questions that I asked for support from my colleagues in the press, Diane Sawyer, Leslie Stahl, and Tom Brokaw, and he asked the question again, wasn't the bar set too high? And they had security take Jeremy out, and as he was walking, as they were taking him out of the back, that's where I was standing, and I said, release that man, he's about to win an award. And so the security was a little confused, but awards were the name of the game that night, and so they released him. And the award... And so the award ceremony began. Tom Brokaw got up, and he was introduced by another executive of the Overseas Press Club, who said, I don't know how best to describe my friend Tom, but 17 years ago, or whenever it was, 1975, I got to know him. When we were on Kissinger's plane together flying back from Asia, I knew about a trip Kissinger took to Asia. It was right before Indonesia invaded East Timor, December 7th, 1975, when Kissinger and President Ford gave the go-ahead in a face-to-face meeting with Suharto, gave the go-ahead for the invasion of East Timor, which led to the occupation and the killing of 200,000 Timorese, one of the great genocides of the 20th century, proportionately larger than Cambodia. And here he was talking about what it was like to be on the press plane sitting next to Tom Brokaw, and he said, you really get to know a man, the measure of a man at a time like that, sitting next to them for 17 hours, except when we would get up to go to the front to have canapes with Kissinger and then sit down again. That's not my commentary, that's what he said to introduce Tom Brokaw. And so Tom got up and he started the award ceremony. And he began the introductions, and it usually you hear that a person's won the Overseas Press Club Award. In fact, it's the Pepsi-Cola Award, it's the Merrill Lynch Award for Business Reporting, it's divided like that. And that's where you hear it, at the award ceremony. And so he started to give out the awards in our category. He gave out to the top winner, and that person got up and talked about the values of journalism and how brave journalists were who refused to cozy up to power. And then this was the moment we make sure our tape recorders were in place, and he said, and now the citation goes to Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill for their documentary called Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. Well, that's not what it was called, and we had had about enough, so I walked up on the stage and I said, Mr. Brokaw, I'm Amy Goodman, and that man you tried to have taken out was Jeremy Scahill. And the name of the documentary, repeat after me, is Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. But we can't accept the award tonight for two reasons. One is because we can't accept it from an organization that during a time like this, the bombing of Yugoslavia, makes an agreement not to question those who were behind it. That's number one. And number two, this event started by congratulating Indonesia for its treatment of journalists. I wouldn't like the dead journalists of Indonesia to hear, and I didn't say this part, what the Overseas Press Club was saying then. But I said, I don't think this is a time to be congratulating Indonesia on its treatment of journalists. We are here to challenge those in power, not to applaud them. So thanks, but no thank you. Anyway, we sat down. And Tom Brokaw, he stood at the stage and he said, it's a great First Amendment. It's a great country. And now, if Pacifica will let us move forward, we will move on with the awards, and went on to the Pepsi-Cola Award, and then later said, he was starting to feel a little uncomfortable. This was not a good situation, clearly, and he said something like Richard Holbrooke agreed he would talk to us later. I think he didn't want to be in this uncomfortable situation he found himself a few weeks before. His new book had just come out, the bestseller, like The Great Generation or something like that, and he had been interviewed by Katie Couric on NBC, The Today Show, which he had formerly been the host of. And so she said to him, how does it feel coming back after all these years? And he said, you know, he had walked over, it was like 3 a.m. to The Today Show to do the interview. And he said on The Today Show, well, you know, it sort of brought back memories. He said, I always used to walk past these homeless people and think, oh boy, they get an hour more sleep than I do. And that sort of caused a little titter in the gossip pages. So I think he was feeling, oh, I hope this isn't going to happen again, you know. So Hillbrook will talk to you guys. Now if Pacifica will allow us to continue. And then he said, well, at the end of the evening, Pacifica will be interviewing Richard Holbrooke, and Andy Rooney will be holding forth on Edward R. Murrow, for those of you who forgot who he was, he said. And then he continued. So that's really what happens amongst the corporate media and the power that they cover. At the end of the evening, we went up to Richard Holbrooke to do that interview they had promised, and he told us to get away from him. He said he had to take his father-in-law home, so I said, could we make an appointment to do an interview? And he said no. We sort of had him cornered at the elevator, and so Leslie Stahl said she'd take him home. Dick, I'll take you home. So that she helped him make his getaway. And so we then went back in. We told Brokaw he wouldn't do the interview. He said he had something else to do. So I went over to Frank Sesno, and I asked him, since I had the opportunity, and we were in the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia, what did he think of his network and the other network's practice of putting retired generals on the payroll, commenting on the bombing, but not putting on peace activists? Would he consider putting peace activists on the payroll? He is like one of the vice presidents of news operations at CNN. And he said, no. And says, well, why would you put generals on the payroll? First of all, the Pentagon will give you their opinion for free. Why do you put them on anyway? But if you're going to, what about peace activists? And he said, because, well, we've thought about this, he said. But it's because the generals are analysts. And the peace activists are advocates. Analysts. Advocates. I think you have to go to an analyst to understand that one. And I said, would he consider having Noam Chomsky on? And he said, I don't know him personally. And now you see what the new criterion is you have to have dinner with Richard Holbrooke, and then you have him on, and he hadn't dined with Noam Chomsky lately. Very serious problems. Well, the next day, the New York Post did a piece on this whole event, and the headline was, Brokaw Shushes Kosovo Crank. So Jeremy looked at that headline and he said, huh, I didn't see Brokaw tell Holbrooke to be quiet. And interestingly enough, though she wouldn't talk to us, Leslie Stahl did comment to the gossip page of the gossip rag that is the New York Post. She did answer their request for an interview about what we had done. And they asked her what they thought of the questioning, and she said it wasn't the time or place. Now, what is a better time or place than the time being the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia and the place being a gathering of hundreds of journalists who cover war? Why wouldn't you ask these questions? So basically, the summary of this story is Tom broke all the rules of good journalism. Leslie stalled, and Frank says no to fine reporting.
Speaking in Vermont at an independent media convergence. You've been listening to the Revolutionary Action Dance Party, produced out of CHSR-FM in Fredericton, New Brunswick. We can be reached by calling us at area code 506-453-4985 or email us at rad@chsr.net. I'm Pierre Loiselle. Thanks for listening.